Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as issues concerning war, peace, and the environment. And today, we're going to have two very special guests with us. The first special guest has written a very disturbing book with a self-explanatory title. The title of the book is Suicidal Planet by Sudhir Rajan. And Mr. Rajan claims that we are on a path of global suicide unless we take drastic measures. Now, I should point out that the book was written during the Bush administration. However, maybe there's perhaps a glimmer of hope. Barack Obama has stated that he would like to get a handle on global warming so that we don't become the suicidal planet. So that's the first guest for the first half hour of Exploration. And then the second half hour, we're going to celebrate the fact that it is the anniversary of the theory of evolution, the anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species, which initiated a blistering firestorm of religious, theological, and scientific debate. And we should also point out that it's the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. And to celebrate that, we're going to talk about the evolution of the human brain. And in fact, we're going to bring on a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Gerald Edelman. He's a Nobel laureate and author of a book called Second Nature, Brain Science and Human Knowledge. So in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the evolution of the human brain with a Nobel Prize winner. So once again, in the first half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Sudhir Rajan, author of a very disturbing book with a self-explanatory title, Suicidal Planet. Are we on the verge of committing global suicide? And then in the second half hour of Exploration, we're going to celebrate the theory of evolution by bringing on a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Gerald Edelman, author of the book Second Nature, Brain Science and Human Knowledge, talking about evolution and the human brain. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Sudhir Rajan. He's the co-author of a new book called The Suicidal Planet. That's right. It's called The Suicidal Planet. And the question is, are we committing suicide by allowing global warming to go out of control? However, the subtitle of the book is How to Prevent Global Climate Catastrophe. So in other words, the first half of the book lays out a very dire scenario, that the planet, in fact, could literally kill itself unless we rein in global warming. And the second half of the book lays out an architecture as to how to solve the problem, specifically the management of carbon, a carbon cap and trade, carbon tax. In this book, they envision everyone on the planet Earth, every industry, has a certain allotment of carbon, and that within that allotment, we can buy and trade carbon credits. But basically, this is the way to rein in carbon dioxide by allowing individuals and corporations to calculate precisely their carbon load. So once again, the book is called The Suicidal Planet, How to Prevent Global Climate Catastrophe. Our special guest is one of the co-authors, Sudhir Rajan. And we're talking about laying out a blueprint for saving the planet. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as you know, a few months ago, released a massive report endorsed by over 1,000 climatologists and reviewed by hundreds more. So could you simply summarize some of the main results and the projections as to what we can expect to find in the future?
Yeah, I mean, just a quick word on this. The IPCC, for short, the Intergovernmental Panel, actually came out with what they acknowledged to be a relatively conservative view of the future. But one of the things they said was, I mean, they used the word unequivocal to describe the connection between human activity and climate change. So that's it's now beyond doubt that we are changing the Earth's climate. That was an important statement by a world body like the IPCC. They also said that we're sort of almost definitely committed to a 2-degree, 2 to 3-degree average sea level rise. Temperature rise in the next in the course of the century. And they also came out with various types of impacts associated with what would happen to water systems, ecosystems, food, coasts, and human health. And all of these impacts get progressively worse. In fact, there are points where things get much, much worse if we go to 3, 4, or 5 degrees Celsius above, pre-industrial levels. There's also an acknowledgement that they didn't actually know how to model ice sheet dynamics and carbon feedback. So there's some confusion about what they said in terms of sea level rise. There's a projection of about, a mean level of about 54 centimeters of sea level rise by the end of the century. But they say that they really didn't know how to take into account the fact that Antarctica and Greenland land ice sheets are in danger of, collapsing. And they don't know exactly how to model that. Various things are associated, various issues associated with that phenomenon aren't well understood. So it's important to recognize that a lot of the projections of the IPCC are themselves conservative.
And speaking about the stability of the Antarctic ice sheet, there was a statement just last month stating that because of the fresh water that runs underneath the Antarctic ice sheet in the west part of Antarctica, there's some concern about the stability of parts of West Antarctica. And, of course, this is purely hypothetical. But in case there is an instability and large chunks of Antarctica slide into the ocean, it could cause a dramatic rise in sea level. But what are your thoughts?
No, absolutely. I mean, that is a concern. And also, in fact, I don't know if you've mentioned this before in one of your programs, but there's a concern that sea level rise may have been accelerating in the past decade or so relative to what the previous IPCC scenarios predicted. So if you look at, there's data, satellite measurements, for instance, showing that the rate of rise itself has gone up. And one of the reasons for that is precisely what you mentioned, melt land ice in Greenland especially is sort of seen to descend is melts into what are called moulins or vertical shafts, and then there's a, sort of a creating a almost like a lubricating layer over the land, and you've seen discharge from Greenland ice streams that that are accelerating, and so it's people are really concerned about these kinds of things happening, and similar things have been observed if you might recall in Antarctica, the ice shelf over there. I forget the name. I think it was the Jacobson ice shelf the Larsen ice shelf in Antarctica, where even though it was actually sea ice, but because it was a large chunk of ice about the size of the state of Rhode Island actually melted and went into the ocean, and you basically freed up land ice that was already starting to melt or break up and go into the ocean, that process started to accelerate. Okay. So there are concerns like that, definitely, that people are trying to identify and figure out how to model.
Okay. Now let's also talk about a worst-case scenario. No one is saying that we will have a worst-case scenario, but a worst-case scenario would involve massive food riots, inundation of major coastal cities, migrations of tens of millions of people, the collapse of whole governments, and the Pentagon, the United States Pentagon, even sees this as a national security issue. And in fact, we even had one of the authors of this Pentagon report on our airwaves, talking about the possible use of nuclear weapons to preserve national boundaries as whole nation states collapse. But what are your thoughts? Do you see if we do nothing, if we do absolutely nothing, do you foresee a worst-case scenario like the one contemplated by the Pentagon? Or, well, what do you think?
Well, let's talk about worst-case scenarios. There's actually a best-case scenario in which people are concerned that by 2050, even if we start doing things today and start, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, it's because of the sort of the thermal inertia of our oceans and atmosphere and the climate system as a whole, that what we'll end up seeing is a certain degree of sea level rise that's going to inundate millions of people. You know, Bangladesh is already under serious risk. Large swaths of the, you know, Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean, Caribbean, Guyana, a lot of deltaic regions are at risk. And millions of people, hundreds of millions of people will become what we refer to as climate exiles. In other words, they're going to be displaced from their homes for no fault of their own. And this is another, you know, huge irony in the whole climate discourse that very few people talk about. You know, the countries that are most at risk and the people who are most at risk from climate change are those who had least to do with the problem. You know, the United States and Europe contribute to about 60% of the global carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. Africa contributes about 2.5%. But if you look at the IPCC report, you know, it's Africa, it's developing countries that are going to bear the brunt of climate impacts. But I mean, obviously, if you start thinking in terms of the worst case scenarios, you know, where these phenomena that we just talked about, you know, in Antarctica and Greenland, and then if, you know, droughts and other things start to get worse, you're going to have, obviously, you're going to have food riots, you're going to have climate exiles, you're going to have all sorts of things happening to millions, hundreds of millions of people by the end of the century.
Okay, now let's talk about energy. You have a chapter called Wishful Thinking, so I imagine that sort of summarizes your attitude toward cosmetic changes in energy. But let's talk about energy. First of all, the hybrid, the plug-in hybrid, the electric car. What impact do you think it would have if we have more hybrid cars on the highways?
Well, let's think in terms of numbers. The U.S. now contributes on an annual basis about 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. If we think in terms of you know, having fair shares across the world in terms of per capita emissions, or at least per capita emissions rights, the average American now contributes roughly 20 tons of carbon dioxide per year, and the fair share would be about an order of magnitude below that, so about 2.5 tons. You know, if currently, you know, the average Indian or the average Chinese contributes, you know, about 4 tons or 6 tons of carbon dioxide, and they obviously have to reduce their emissions as well. But if you think in terms of you know, just technology changes reducing individual footprints, that's not going to happen in the near term. We really have to think about technology and behavioral changes, and that's why we talk about putting a cap on personal carbon emissions. We talk about personal carbon allowances and a trading system within countries, and this is something that has been taken very, very seriously in the UK, for instance. The UK currently, you know, the average footprint of a Briton is about 10 tons of carbon dioxide per year, and but they're already talking about you know, introducing a scheme where every individual will have an entitlement that will start ratcheting down year after year, so that sort of converges towards a fair per capita emissions that everybody in the globe would have for a stable climate. And a stable climate implies somewhere in the order of 350 to 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere.
Okay, well, let's try to break this down. You mentioned that every American produces 50 tons of carbon dioxide per year.
20.
20 tons, I'm sorry. Now, break that down. Of the 20 tons of carbon dioxide that every American produces per year, how much comes from transportation and how much comes from home heating or what have you?
Yeah. So the 20 tons actually can be divided into household use and use associated with the purchase of goods and services. In other words, what people actually produce by individually and what the rest of the economy produces.
Mm-hmm.
So that ratio is about roughly half and half. Actually, it's 9 and 11. Nine tons of carbon dioxide per individual for for the household and transportation, and about 11 from all other uses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you break that down further, transportation, alone is about 4 tons, and the rest is so the remaining 5 tons or so comes from other uses. But transportation, I'm not actually including air travel. Air travel contributes a ton on average for the average individual. So if you include air travel, so it's again half and half, probably maybe more for transportation. But these are all averages we're talking about.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about carbon allowances in a minute, but let's sort of get the background of, where the 20 tons comes from and what we can do to perhaps reduce some of that 20 tons of carbon dioxide per American per year. First of all, energy usage. If we were to go away from gasoline and more toward hybrids and plug-in hybrids and electric cars and stuff like that, what do you think we could do to the amount that we generate from our transportation sector?
Okay, so the average car, if you think about the average individual, and we stay with individual, the average individual for his or her car or SUV or whatever produces about 3.8 tons of CO2 per year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could effectively cut that in half by switching to hybrids or plug-in hybrids. You couldn't do a whole lot more than that. You could, if you just use technology and you switch and you change, made no changes in behavior, that's what you'd get. But you could, in fact, and there's been lots of evidence from other countries that people travel, do a lot of what's called excess travel, and it's quite easy just by keeping a log to reduce your travel by about 20% with nothing, no other changes. Instead of driving to the store 6 times a week, you could drive 4 times a week or 3 times a week. Plan your day, plan your week, do your errands differently, carpool once in a while. It's relatively easy to reduce your travel, and this is especially true in places like California, where driving has just sort of exploded because people have extra cars and they just feel that they need to drive. So technology and lifestyle changes are essential.
Okay. Now, we talked about reducing the amount of carbon dioxide produced in the transportation sector by changing our habits and lifestyles and new technologies. What about coal-fired plants and fossil fuel plants? Of the 20 tons of carbon dioxide generated by every American per year, what percent or what fraction comes from coal-fired plants?
Well, if you just look at the personal footprint, in other words, if you just look at the home and travel part,
mm-hmm.
so household electricity
mm-hmm.
is 2.8 tons from electricity per individual. And our coal fraction is roughly, and I may be off, but I think it's about 40%. 40% of our electricity on average in the United States comes from coal-fired plants. And coal generally produces about twice as much CO2 per kilowatt hour as, say, gas.
Mm-hmm.
So, cutting down on coal can play a major role. But again, I want to emphasize that, technology can only go so far. Because a lot of the coal plants have been around and will be around for the next 30 years or so. And so if you think just in terms of new power plants, you know, shifting from coal to gas or something else, or going to even, you know, renewables, you're going to make a slow change, but it's not going to be fast enough. So that's something to be concerned about as well.
Okay. Now, the thrust of your book talks about carbon allowances, carbon rationing, and watching carbon. Could you elaborate it? Because this, of course, goes to the very heart of your book in order to get an architecture for a blueprint to save the planet. So what do you mean by carbon allowances?
Yeah. First of all, let me just throw out this phrase, contraction and convergence, because I don't think we've talked about it yet. And contraction and convergence is a framework that Mayer Hillman and Aubrey Mayer in the UK have developed over the course of you know, two decades. And it's a very simple, straightforward framework. And the idea is that the two principles that need to be adhered to. One is that we should be concerned with equity, global equity. And the second is we should be committed to the survival, you know, of the planet. And contraction and convergence basically says that we need to contract the total global carbon emissions down to a sustainable level, but we should also converge towards a per capita emissions across the entire global population. And so the idea is that, you know, just as we had the Kyoto Protocol, which was an agreement among nations, we need to have a post-Kyoto agreement that sort of adheres to this set of principles of contraction and convergence, because it's the only fair framework that we can see for developing such an agenda. Alongside that, you know, within countries, you'd want to sort of keep that same set of principles of, you know, equity and survival. And so within countries, you'd want to have these personal carbon allowances framework. And David Miliband, who's the Environment Secretary in Britain, he's actually been very serious about promoting this. And he's given several speeches. He actually wants to try this out on a trial basis. Would you like me to explain a little more what that...
Well, carbon allowances. What do you mean by carbon allowances?
Right. So every individual, I mean according to this framework, every individual would have a set of allowances. So, in other words, it's basically carbon becomes a new currency. Just as we carry bank cards to you know, and credit cards and so on, we'll have new cards that store both you know, dollars and carbon points. So when we buy electricity or gas or fuel, we'll use up our carbon points as well as our dollars. And then, but on an annual basis, that will start, the carbon points will start ratcheting down. Now, the way this isn't sort of government intervention top-down kind of thing, because it is very market-friendly. You end up, you could end up trading your excess carbon points. So let's say you don't have an SUV, but your friend or your neighbor does. You could basically have this, you know, you'll have spare carbon points that you could trade to your neighbor, but next year he or she will actually end up having to, you know, find it more profitable to sell their SUV and buy a hybrid and start the, accumulating carbon points for trading. So it's basically a way, it's a way to encourage, incentivize people to reduce their overall carbon burden while also becoming aware of how much they're using.
Okay, now how do you calculate these carbon allowances and who enforces it? That is, if you're a consumer, do you then have to calculate, you know, how many tons of carbon this contributes, how many tons of carbon that contributes? And once you calculate this number, who enforces it?
Well, initially, I mean, in the book, what we proposed is something very simple. So just for personal travel and personal household energy use, we'd have carbon points deducted from the utility or the, you know, gas station. So every time you you go and buy gas, you actually know there's a direct correlation between the type of fuel you have and the amount of fuel you consume and your carbon consumption. And so this card, this credit card that you carry, would basically deduct those points on a daily basis as you buy fuel for travel and household needs. Now, who would enforce it is a very good question. I mean, initially we're saying basically that the government would, either the local government or the state government or the federal government, could set up an agency to sort of basically develop an overall framework. It's sort of like the trading schemes that you have for sulfur dioxide, for combating acid rain, where, you know, basically the power plants had to go through this this cap and trade system. Here we just have individuals do it. And there's something similar being set up in on the East Coast called REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And it's, again, you have a similar sort of a system, a trading system that's initially set up by government rules, but could be monitored through an independent agency. And finally, you could actually basically have an eBay-type system to sell and, you know, to buy excess credits.
So all of us would have this credit card. When you load up on gas, you give the credit card to the attendant, and he then, I guess, deducts carbon from that card. Every time you pay your utility bill, I guess utilities also deduct from that card, right? Is that how it works?
That's right.
Now, the other question is, who sets the maximum amount? You mentioned that 20 tons of carbon dioxide is what every average American produces per year. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that a fair share would be maybe a tenth of that. So what happens when you very rapidly exhaust your allowance? What happens then?
Well, the way it would work is we're talking about the next 2 to 3 decades. So for ratcheting down these the cap, and so and like I mentioned earlier, it's relatively easy on an individual basis to reduce your carbon emissions without doing very much. And the other thing is that there's a great deal of disparity. I mean, the poor tend to emit a lot less than the wealthy. And there's been lots of evidence for that. In fact, in the UK, some studies have shown that there's a factor of 12 in the emissions, per capita emissions of poor people versus the wealthy. And so, basically, taking advantage of these differences and the fact that it's relatively easy to make these changes, and that, you know, you're going to ratchet these down over time.
And that concludes our interview with Sudhir Rajan, author of a very disturbing new book called Suicidal Planet. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And stay tuned for the second half of Exploration as we celebrate the anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species, talking about the evolution of the brain with a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Gerald Edelman, talking about the evolution of the brain. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a very disturbing dialogue with Sudhir Rajan, author of a very controversial book called Suicidal Planet. Are we on the verge of committing global suicide? Unless we begin the process of seizing control of our environment and our destiny. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to celebrate the anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species by Charles Darwin by talking about the evolution of the human brain. And in fact, we're going to bring on a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Gerald Edelman, winner of the Nobel Prize and author of a new book called Second Nature. So we are going to be talking about the evolution of the human brain. And in fact, Dr. Edelman has his own theory of consciousness as well. So once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to celebrate evolution and the human brain. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest today. We're very glad to have with us a Nobel laureate. That's right, a Nobel laureate who is now specializing on trying to unravel the secrets of the brain. We're talking to Dr. Gerald Edelman, winner of the Nobel Prize and author of a new book on the human brain called Second Nature, Brain Science and Human Knowledge. So believe it or not, sitting on your shoulders is perhaps the most complex object known to science out to trillions of miles out to the nearest star. And yet we know so little about its inner workings. And yet Dr. Edelman has proposed a new theory of consciousness, and a new theory of brain science. So once again, today we are talking about the frontiers of brain research with a Nobel laureate, Dr. Gerald Edelman. The first question for you is, as a youth, how did you first get interested in science?
Well, I was, in fact, most interested in music and, in fact, trained to become a concert violinist.
Oh, is that right?
Of course, at that stage of the game, I did fool around a bit. For example, I tried to make a welding machine out of a woman's hair curler, a brazing rod, and some nichrome wire for resistance. Mm-hmm. And I knew Ohm's law, but when I plugged it in, I almost blew up the house in terms of bypassing all the circuit breakers. My father was not pleased.
I see.
I had some interest, in other words, in gadgets, but that wasn't really the incentive. What happened after I did actually get to the point of playing recitals is I realized that I wasn't a performer, that I wasn't interested in energizing the occasion. I was interested in the music. So I thought I'd compose, but then it turned out I had no gift whatsoever. My father was a doctor, and I thought, well, maybe what I could do is some kind of research. And I thought research was medical research, and that drove me in that direction.
And that eventually led to the Nobel Prize.
Well, yes, it's a long eventually. What happened, in fact, is I became interested in studying immunity and the fundamental molecule of immunity, which was called gamma globulin in those days. It's called immunoglobulin today. It's a molecule that recognizes foreign molecules that come into your body, either from viruses or bacteria or anything. And my group and I solved the entire chemical structure of immunoglobulin, and that led eventually to the award of a Nobel Prize.
And that was an amazing discovery, right? Helping to unlock one of the most complex molecular systems of the body, the human immune system.
Yes, of course, there were other people who had sketched out the image of the thing, but this work gave it a kind of, concreteness, since, in fact, the molecular structure was the clue to how the whole system worked.
Okay. Well, since you're an expert in the biomolecular chemistry of the immune system, what then prompted you to make the leap into the whole question of the brain and consciousness?
Well, it wasn't a leap. It was a slide. In fact, I would like to say that every event of my life is more characterized by that metaphor than by a leaping. In any case, what happened is after I solved that structure, and gave a good reason to back up the idea of how the immune system works, which is an interesting thing in itself we might discuss, I decided to work in developmental biology, and I started to work on the retina of the eye and the brain, and we dissected retinae out of chick embryos to solve the problem of how cells stick together, the different nerve cells or neurons. How does one recognize another and stick together to make a tissue? And in the course of that, we discovered what are called cell adhesion molecules. which are a very interesting thing in themselves. They, in fact, had the same kind of structure as antibodies. That was not prefigured in anything we did. At that point, I became more and more interested in the brain and the idea of recognition. Immune molecules recognize foreign molecules, but, of course, there's no thinking involved. So I sort of said, well, maybe we should look into how the brain actually works and how it recognizes how you perform acts of perception and memory and feeling and that kind of thing. So I sort of slid into it.
Okay. And speaking about brain research, which goes, of course, way back centuries, there's been a polarized debate between at least two camps. One is a so-called dualist camp that says that perhaps physical forces are not the only ones involved, that perhaps mind is something beyond physical forces. And then we have the other camp, which is more reductionist, which says that, well, the brain is a bunch of neurons, and if you pile up all these neurons together, perhaps you can understand consciousness and thinking. But what are your thoughts now about the philosophy toward the brain?
Well, let me start again, if I'm not too pedantic about it, with the great French philosopher René Descartes, philosopher and mathematician, who in his search for absolute certainty of knowledge said, I think, therefore I am, in Latin, cogito, ergo sum, in French, je pense, donc je suis. And he decided that, in fact, the world was divided into two kinds of substances, extended things, res extensa, which physics could examine and science could examine, and res cogitans, which didn't have any time or space, and thus he began the whole notion of dualism. And that is the notion that, in fact, consciousness is not connected directly to the workings of the brain, but exists in an entire sphere inaccessible to science. Clearly, as a scientist, I don't agree with that notion. Of course, when you disagree with a genius like René Descartes, you wish you could play his wrong notes. So I am definitely of the opinion that consciousness arises as a result of the workings of the brain, particularly of a specific part of the brain, specific different parts of the brain, which we might be able to discuss.
Okay. Now, some people claim that we are at the brink of a revolution in brain science because of instruments like brain scans, MRI, CAT scans, that allow us to see the thinking brain in motion. We have indirect measurements of blood flow and other functions of the thinking brain, the living thinking brain, that for the first time in history allows us to see how thoughts move back and forth. Could you elaborate a little bit about these discoveries that are being made almost daily?
Well, these discoveries owe themselves, in fact, to your field to a great extent, to physics.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that magnetic resonance imaging can take place, so-called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, allows you to see when a particular nerve area in the living brain, without invasion at all, when that particular area is active, it changes the hemoglobin or the red pigment of your blood in such a way as to reflect whether it has more or less oxygen, and thus is an indirect indicator of activity of that part of the brain. There's a huge amount of research being done there, and the technique is really marvelous. There's only one problem with it. It is slow. Your neurons fire up very quickly, electrically, and this technique will not pick up that. Nor will it pick up all the nuances, but nonetheless, it's a very important thing to indicate that certain parts of the brain light up in terms of their blood flow when you're thinking about this or doing that or whatever. There's another technique, also dependent on physics, called magnetoencephalography, which measures, non-invasively again, without going into your head, which measures the actual minute magnetic currents that go along with the electrical currents of the brain. And if you do that in a shielded room, you can see very fast responses, but it isn't as resolved in terms of space. In fact, it can only look at maybe 1 or 2 centimeters of the brain, whereas the other technique could go down to millimeters. So we're looking, of course, finally, for a technique that will combine them both. But in the meantime, it's been a very great advance and extremely useful. The problem is not to make the mistake of thinking because an area lights up that it is sufficient for a particular function. For example, if I say, when I have someone look at a particular visual image, that this area in the back of his brain lights up, that that's the way it happens right there. No, it's not the action, it's the interaction, and even fMRI doesn't show all of that.
And as an aside, I should just point out that when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, my boss during my summer job won the Nobel Prize, for developing fMRI and MRI technology. Anyway, moving on, let's talk about the structure of the brain now. We look at the gray matter, but of course, the scientists over centuries have been able to pick apart the structure and the functions of different parts of the brain. And some people look at the brain via the lens of evolution, that the brain in some sense is a museum of all the previous stages that we've gone through over millions of years, starting with the back of the brain. Could you elaborate the back of the brain, the brainstem? Some people call it the reptilian brain, the oldest part of the brain, and the brain, of course, that is found in reptiles.
Well, yes. Let me first state that at the end of the 19th century was the great flourishing of a field called neuroanatomy, and the greatest of those investigators was Santiago Ramón y Cajal, a Spanish microscopist who worked in Madrid pretty much alone, and he began to tease out all of the different nerve fibers of the brain.
Now, the back of the brain, including the brainstem, is perhaps the oldest part of the brain in terms of evolutionary function, and the front part of a brain and the top part of a brain is perhaps the latest part of our evolution. But what about everything in between? So tell us a little bit about the parts of the human brain.
The brain is a very complex structure. It's probably the most complicated material object in the known physical universe. The fact is it consists of hundreds of different areas and anatomical connections. And, of course, it is a product of evolution. Now, I think the best way to approach this problem is to first give a little sketch of the parts of the brain. The one you mentioned before, the hindbrain, consists of a portion called the pons and the medulla, and something called the spinal cord, which you know about. That's the one which unfortunately gets severed when there's a motorcycle accident or a football crunch and leaves paralysis. There's also a big part of your brain called the cerebellum in the back, which governs the consistency and integration of movements, of fast movements. And finally, there is the center of the brain, which consists of things that also detect movement, but other things that relay signals up to the major portion of the brain, which is so important in human beings, called the cerebral cortex. That's the wrinkled structure that you can see in certain diagrams. Wrinkled because it's extensive enough in our evolution, so it has to be folded into the bony box of your head. When you look at the cortex, it consists of at least 200 different areas that can be identified in terms of function and structure. But the main thing is it's more or less the same. It's a six-layered structure. And I think it's worth giving your listeners a view of how many cells there are in it and what that means. I said it was the most complicated material object. Well, in the cortex, if you pulled it out and laid it flat on a table, it would be the size of a large table napkin and about as thick. It would have 30 billion neurons or nerve cells and a million billion connections. That means if you counted one connection per second, you would never stop counting until 32 million years later. And that's just counting them. That's not calculating the different ways in which they can be connected. Now, to go to your question, what happened, in fact, in hominid evolution, or the evolution that led to human beings, was in a very short order, the cortex, particularly the front part of the cortex, the prefrontal area, as they call it, enlarged enormously. And that's really one of the most fantastic pieces of evolutionary hardware one can think of. And it's quite clear that that was, in fact, the reason for our intellectual capabilities and finally our ability to invent language.
Okay, well, some people say that the back of the brain is the oldest. Then as mammals began to develop, they developed a social structure which required emotions and learning to interact with each other, and the center part of the brain, among many other functions, also includes emotions and social interactions, and the front part and the top part of the brain is the so-called thinking brain.
Well, here we are at this juncture, which, of course, you heard me reject before. Namely, there is a debate that has gone on since the 19th century called the debate between localizationism,
mm-hmm.
the fact that each part has a certain function, and holism, which says, no, it's the whole brain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the truth lies in neither. The truth lies in the fact that the brain is a highly interactive structure, and the different combinations of interaction across all the different areas are what really count. So while an area can be necessary
mm-hmm.
for a thing, it might not be sufficient. It
uh-huh.
has to interact with other things.
Okay.
So you don't locate emotions or consciousness in any nerve cell or place per se. It's a function having to do with interaction. So let's talk about that for a minute, because emotions, for example, involve a deep set of interactions between the more primitive parts of the brain, the back parts, as you've called them, and, say, the cortex. And it's the multiple interactions of all those areas, of hormones and of molecules called neurotransmitters, which are the ones that make neurons fire and one neuron connect to another in terms of function. All of those play upon particular emotions in a great combination of different possibilities.
And what about structures like the amygdala, which has been in the news recently as people
try to... Well, the amygdala is a portion of the brain, which, in fact, some people have asserted is responsible for fear responses.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably too narrow. The amygdala is certainly involved in a number of things having to do with emotional reactions and warnings. Perhaps the best way to look at this thing is to say the following, that the brain, besides having all these connections which lead to perception and finally to signals to the spinal cord to give motion in our various muscle systems, there is a set of value systems, a set of systems that have evolved to sort of act as warnings or rewards. A good example is something that goes by a fancy name called locus coeruleus, the blue spot, which is in that hindbrain you're talking about. And it's a very small number of neurons, but it sends out fibers all over the brain like a hairnet, and also like a leaky garden hose, so that if you hear a very loud sound, for example, this system will release something called norepinephrine, a neurotransmitter, all over, leak it all over in such a way as to change how quickly and how differently neurons or nerve cells fire. There's another one of great interest called dopaminergic system. That releases a neurotransmitter called dopamine, which is responsible for giving rewards. Now, all of those systems are inherited, and there are about six of them, and they interact in this complex play to yield what we call emotion.
Okay, now let's talk about comparing the brain to a computer. Some people say that the brain is not a computer, contrary to popular belief. There's no Windows up there. There's no Pentium chip. There's no programming. There's no software. There are
right.
no subroutines. Therefore, the brain cannot be a computer. But what are your thoughts?
I am at the forefront of that movement. I have been so since the early 1970s, and the evidence is overwhelming that it has none of the properties of what people in the computer business call a Turing machine, after Alan Turing, the great British mathematician, who wrote a theorem that said that he can show you with this theorem that he can carry out any set of effective procedures or algorithms that you can name as long as they're unambiguous. What he had to do is call upon a tape which had binary arithmetic zeros and ones, and it could read and write and erase and move to the right or the left. And he proved mathematically, very formally consistent, that this machine could carry out any such set. So you might ask, why not the brain? Well, here's one of the problems. The world is not a piece of tape. The piece of tape must have unambiguous writing on it that instructs the machine. So the machine is an instructive system. The brain, in fact, is a selectional system. It already has a huge number of possibilities, and you pick amongst them to strengthen one or another, depending on your experience. The real argument against the brain being a computer is both structural and functional. When you look at the embryology of the brain, how the brain develops as a structure in an embryo or whatever, or in a fetus as it's growing, you see that neurons that fire together wire together. It's not genetic at all. It isn't prefixed. Certain things are, but most things are not. So every individual brain is indeed individual in the history of the universe. And, in fact, that's a non-trivial statement. but it's no way to run a computer company.
Okay.
In fact, you can't really say you're going to be writing a program for a six-month-old baby.
Okay. Now, at the opposite extreme, some people say the brain is a neural network, a learning machine that constantly rewires itself as it learns new tasks. Therefore, it requires no programming. It learns like a baby simply by having stimuli come at it. What are your thoughts?
Of course, that's equally extreme and not quite correct. The fact is there are genetic constraints which govern certain things that you do inherit and which do limit what the brain can do. So it's not a blank slate. You just don't write on it the way you just said. It is a combination, and we can get to this, of this huge number of possibilities in which certain ones are fixed depending on your evolution and certain others are fixed depending on your actual experience. But that requires a theory of the brain. Maybe we can talk about that later.
Okay, we will in a minute. But also the question of consciousness. People have, of course, pulled their hair out trying to define consciousness. People in artificial intelligence theory lean toward the idea that consciousness is a stream of images, a stream of sensory perceptions that hit the brain, and the brain associates certain emotions or conclusions with this stream of images that come at it. But that's how artificial intelligence people look at consciousness. But what are your thoughts? What is consciousness?
Well, the way I would answer that is to say that, first of all, the great philosopher and psychologist William James, the early part of the 20th century, who wrote this magnificent book, Principles of Psychology, perhaps gave the most clear-cut description for the first time of consciousness. Not a question of definition. It's a form of awareness, as he pointed out, and here's the most important thing. It is not a thing. It is a process. It cannot be embodied as a thing. It is a set of relationships and a process that occur, all right? And third of all, as we all know, it's private in the sense that it's linked to your body and not to my body. There's no telepathy involved. You, therefore, when you have a set of feelings, while you can convey them to me, I can't really know exactly what you're feeling because it's private and because it's connected to your brain and your body. It is also possessed of what they call intentionality. That's not like intention. It's the idea that consciousness is pretty much always about things. But that's not absolute because we've talked about emotions. For example, a mood is not a thing, and consciousness involves moods. It involves thoughts. It involves feelings. It involves all those things. And the main thing is this, that it doesn't exhaust everything that you experience. It is modulated or changed by attention, as you know. And finally, the most important thing to point out about it is the curious combination of what its unitary nature, namely, you can't just be conscious of, say, the microphone in front of you and nothing else. You're conscious of the whole room, the microphone, the feeling of the seat on your back, all of those things, the smells, all of those integrative things constitute a stream of what James called the stream of consciousness. It's unitary, but at the same time, it changes enormously. If you think of your high school graduating class, or you think of some physics formula where you first learned it, there's an enormous spread of possibilities. So it's both integrated and differentiated, and it's a system for making discrimination. That is a very important thing.
Okay.
It is not a system for governing your immediate, quicker action. So perhaps I could give you the image of a concert pianist who's practicing a concerto. He takes out a certain musical phrase, and he practices it slowly until it becomes automatic. Then he hooks up another one. And finally, he gets the whole movement. He does start with consciousness, but then it becomes unconscious, like riding a bicycle or typing, etc., at a computer. Now, say he plays. And the conductor is going along very nicely, and all of a sudden the conductor slows the beat without warning. Well, here's where consciousness comes in. It starts to make discriminations. Hey, I better change this, I better change that. Consciousness is not necessary for the movement of my fingers in the detailed sense because I've already learned that.
Okay.
So it's the most remarkable property.
Well, if you look at the animal kingdom and you talk about the concept of self-awareness and you put an animal in front of a mirror, not every animal recognizes that object in the mirror is itself.
To say the least.
Right. So what about the question of evolution of consciousness and self-awareness, especially
right.
in the animal
well,
kingdom?
I think we have to dissect those apart from each other for the moment. But let's put it this way. Consciousness as a field for experimentation, which is now happening for the first time, we're taking it a bit away from the philosophers. Consciousness is that kind of field. Is best performed in the largest sense on human beings because we have language and we can report our consciousness. I'll get to that in a moment. But to come to your question, for instance, certain apes can, in fact, recognize themselves having a spot on their forehead. If you paint a red spot on their forehead, they'll gaze in a mirror and be intrigued by that. Monkeys, in general, will not have that trait. So people have concluded, somewhat rashly perhaps, that that means that there's self-awareness. There's certainly the ability to connect their image and the distortion of the image by the spot in a way that other species cannot. So let me go back and say what I think about when evolution gave rise to consciousness. But of course, having said what I said about experimentation, it's very hard to prove what you believe, for example, that your dog is conscious. So let me say that sometime about 250 million years ago, a set of reptiles called therapsid reptiles were the precursors of both birds and of mammals. And at that particular point, a particular change occurred in the wiring of the back of the brain to the front of the brain that allowed this process of integration that I talked about to occur.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest in the first half hour was Sudhir Rajan, author of a very disturbing book called Suicidal Planet. And the author of the second part of Exploration was Dr. Gerald Edelman, winner of the Nobel Prize and author of the book Second Nature, about the evolution of the human brain, and he even proposes a new theory of consciousness in that book. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. Good day.